12, 2008 will come to order, and we're going to open a session on House Bill 3618. And I'm going to ask Mazin to run us through the amendment, which is, I think, the Dash 4 amendment, which is the latest one that we've talked about on this one. And colleagues, let me say that my intention now is to get back to this either tonight at our carry forward meeting at 7 o'clock, or tomorrow meeting off the floor. And at this point, I don't know where we are on that, but I'll let you know during the day. So when it comes time, we'll recess this meeting with the potential that we'll pick it up again tonight. Mazin.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 4 amendment is an improvement primarily on the Dash 3. The Dash 4 is the one that contains the table with tail going down on the from the 7.5 to the 15 million on the steepest slope. And in that, with the sheet that I passed to you yesterday, would produce the lowest revenue impact as we saw it. Now, to go with the quick differences and changes that the dashboard does, and how it is different from the Dash 3, it has in the first page going on line 3 for the Dash 4 amendment. If you read that, it takes a little more expansion or definition on the fisheries or the commercial fishing. This is with the B, as you see it on line 5. Basically says that it needs to be a licensed under Chapter 508. This is a commercial fishing licenses, and going down onto all the different requirements. Then going to line 14, the C, that is the tangible and intangible personal property devoted for use in the farm. These things are the ones that we discussed yesterday, and it includes the timber, crops, equipment, and so on. D is the working capital of the farm and natural resource business. And then, as we mentioned before, the credit table on page 2 is the prominent piece. The difference with this credit table than the other one, it would be last line where we added from 15 million and on, or above 15 million, we get the zero credit and 0%. That was missing from the previous credit. On the page 3, we put the maximum just to make sure that this is we assumed it was the issue. However, it was needed to be mentioned in law that on line 7 of that page 3 in the amendment, that the gross estate does not exceed 15 million. Otherwise, you would be looking at states of 30 million for the 50%, and that takes credit.
Oh, I see.
So that's where the difference that needed to be. I mean, it was subliminally understood, but not in language.
Right.
So we had to put that in language. In line 10, that's still carries from the previous amendment, or the same
right.
Amendment. 75 going to 50% is still here. And then inserting the domestic partner in the different places. The references to 3C, because that changed, you'll find it from lines 19 to 22. And I'm happy to say that line 24, deleting the colon and insert the comma, is still there, and that's again my contribution to this.
Congratulations.
The the family after. Then you would have the in line 28. This is the one that was discussed over and over yesterday after we had the meeting here in the committee, work group, and everybody came together to look into this issue of the material participation. And I think the language that was suggested would be this language that we have here. We took it verbatim from the suggestion of the work group. And I think also Heather Gilmore from the bar is here to probably shed some more light on that discussion after we're done with the amendment, if you'd like to do that. So the material participation basically refers to the federal code 2032A, and it is defined as the active management defined in that federal code, which is a lot less restrictive, if you will, than would be the material participation found in, let's say, the personal income type of definitions.
Ah, okay.
And to give more of an idea of what the code actually talks about, we've included in your packet this the paper called Tax and Accounting Center. This was sent to us by Deborah Buchanan, and what this does is primarily puts the English language of what material participation tests are on top of the actual code that you'd see. So you'd have two pieces each year, the code as it appears in the federal code and federal regulations, and then the English meaning and translation of it is on top of that. Okay, and that goes page 1, 2, and 3, and that well, basically defines what level of restriction we have in that. The fund of revenue would be also, although the Department of Revenue was given a blanket statement of definition of what material participation is in the previous amendment, in this amendment, as you would see it in the page 4, line 1, 2, it gives that definition ability by the Department of Revenue explicitly for this material participation, just in case material participation does not apply to commercial fishing, let's say, and forestry, as well as it's defined and applies to agriculture. So this, Mr. Chair, is a one that explicitly does that by giving the Department of Revenue that rule-making ability on that. So, and that's an additional, again, as I said, the blanket. Still the requirements or the ability to get a conservation contribution, and then you go to the lines, right? And then when you have you remember the issue about the dead person or the decedent having the talking, and I think although that the language was probably workable, but it I think Representative Berger then
I just don't like giving that authority to the dead people. it's overstepping their bounds.
You're underestimating our ability to communicate with the dead. I can assure you. However, I think that was
they didn't get a workaround. They did find a workaround.
Yes, okay. The workaround is if you look at line 15 on page 4, we took the decedent out completely. So the decedent is although the decedent has been out. I mean, that was a poor choice of words. not meant to be that way. Sorry.
But so the language on line 1 then takes care of that. The new language on line 1.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
So you would have also here the Other cleanup on the language from line 17 in the amendment 1725 on, and those the more important thing in the 19 to 21 is when is the tax due and when do they get an extension, and that kind of definition and problem that was brought up also yesterday. So that makes it, given the not required to do it until June 30th, 2008. So that takes care of the technical issues of this. Let me back to the couple of pages that we gave you about the tax code. In the absolute back page, I've added also the two tax tables. These represent what you would have on the when you're looking at your taxes, estate taxes on the federal side and the state. So the table B would be what we would look at to estimate or calculate the tax for the state, for the Oregon. And this table, if you look at it and try to, let's say, go down to where you would have $7,040,000 to $8,040,000, and you would have the tax in amount one, this is the next column up, would say $650,800, and then the percentage is 13.6. The 13.6 would be applied against the difference between the 8 million or above 7 million and below 8 million. So anytime between those, that's where the percentage you apply in addition to. So it works precisely as the person of income tables would do. So at 7.5 million today, you're looking at about $705,202. Okay? That's what your tax liability would be on natural resource property. Mm-hmm. Your credit tables on page 4, as you would go, that, and we've split out all these amounts in order to come up to that threshold, not only threshold, but the point of inflection at $7.5 million. So at $7.5 million, you take the $650,800, 13.6, you see that difference. If you get up to that amount at $7.5 million, you have exactly the same credit as you would have liability. So it is.
There's no tax.
There is no tax. There's 1-to-1 relationship between liability and tax. I'm sorry.
And that was liability and credit.
Yes. Now, the difference with that is. This is a credit, so it works as a credit, and it's not an exclusion, so it doesn't work as an exclusion. And the difference means if you have $15 million estate, let's say that it meets the requirement of 50%, so you would have $7.5 million in your natural resource property. What you would do is, first of all, you go to the tables and find out what's your $15 million liability. Okay, then you go to the credit table and you find how much your credit is, which is the full credit of what otherwise would have been, and that's the amount of credit you take against your liability. If it was an exclusion, what would happen is you will take the $7.5 million of value and throw them out, and you take the $7.5 million that are left and go to the tables, and you don't go to the 16%, but you go down in the table to the 10.4%. So you basically change all your levels of taxation. And that's the difference between the exclusion versus the credit kind of thing.
I'm sorry.
So we wanted to, and that, as you remember, there was the discussion at the time when we started this process, is whether it needs to be an exclusion or an exemption on the amount of the cliff and so on. So this credit, the idea that we borrowed from the personal income tax processes, which is more flexible, and in a way it is a hybrid that was able to bridge the differences, if you will, between the understanding of an exemption versus the exclusion versus the cliff versus the gradual.
Trying to deal with several issues in the same process.
And I'm yes, proud to say that technically, at least, I mean, regardless of policy questions, technically, at least, that works.
Okay. Questions for Mazin before we go ahead?
Heather, did you want to talk a little bit about the issue involving participation? Maybe you didn't want to, but would you?
Yes. Mr. Chair and representatives, I'm Heather Gilmore. I've been serving on the Oregon State Bar's ad hoc committee regarding this legislation, and we've been working with the accountants and the lawyers to provide some technical policy assistance to clarify what the committee would like to do and what the legislature intends this bill to say, so that as practitioners we can use it properly. We have four questions as a result of this current draft. And the first question is, does the committee want dollar for dollar tax relief for the ownership of natural resource property? If they do, the current table does not work because it provides a credit. And let me give you the difference.
Do you have some written testimony?
Do you have written testimony?
I do not. I'm sorry. We've submitted other testimony that's similar. So this is a recap. We just got the bill probably at 9:30, I believe.
Yeah, and we haven't had it any longer than that either.
Right, so we're operating off of pencil notes. So under the law that was passed in June, if you had $7.5 million of natural resource property and $2 million of additional property like bank accounts, your tax would be $106,000. And that's dollar-for-dollar relief. Mm-hmm. With this dollar-for-dollar credit...
Excuse me, under the definitions that exist in the current law.
Correct.
Right.
With the proposed legislation, with the dollar-for-dollar credit, you would have the same $7.5 million of natural resource property, $2 million of ordinary property, and your tax would be $286,000. So that's a difference between tax relief, dollar per dollar, and tax credit. The reason that it works out that way is because under Oregon law, if you have 7.5 of natural resource, 2 million of ordinary property, your first million is free of tax. Then we would apply the natural resource credit for your natural resource property, and you would pay you would get a credit for the value of that. And then on your additional $1 million, you'd be essentially paying tax at the highest bracket. And so while you do have a credit for your natural resource property, it inflates your bracket for your other ordinary property. And so the question for the committee is that the result you desire? Or is it the result that you want dollar for dollar relief? That's the policy question.
I think, in fairness, in asking this question, you have to acknowledge that there's a difference between the two situations, another difference. And the other difference is that unless you are fortunate to have your property completely fit under the definition of the current law, unless that happens, then you're actually comparing apples and oranges, because the new law changes the definition of what natural resources property is. So if you own a farm, and on that farm you own rolling stock of various kinds, under the old definition that's not included as natural resource property. Under the definition of the bill, it is. So your exemption, your the amount you get your credit on is larger under the bill
than the amount you would have under a natural resources definition under the current law. So in order to make comparisons, you have to look at both issues at the same time. Otherwise, you can't make that comparison.
We're just using land. If you own land, and we're,
right.
The purpose is to solely illustrate the difference between dollar-for-dollar relief and dollar-for-dollar credit.
And, of course, it does. Your point's well taken. Let me put it a different way. It would affect different people differently depending upon their actual circumstances.
Right? Correct.
Okay. Thank
Correct.
You.
So that's the first question. The second question
is...
Representative
Berger.
Can we pursue this just a moment longer?
Right.
So I guess I'm trying to get a scale of what this would mean for someone who has your 80%. Say, and I forget the figures you used, but what it would do is throw the non-tax assets into a higher tax bracket, is what you're saying.
It would throw the non-farmer forest into a higher bracket, correct.
And what are those brackets? What's the scale of that? I mean, would it go from 1% to 2% or from...
It's this list.
Well, it's that list plus... I think Mazin just gave an example. It's that list plus the ordinary bracket.
Right. Well, and that's what we're looking at, is the bracket.
It's the bracket. So this is the...
Table B.
It is... Under the current plan, if you had a $2 million estate and no farm property, under the current law, we're not worried about the farm exemption. If you had a $2 million estate and no farm property, you owe $106,000 in Oregon inheritance tax. In addition to other taxes that you might owe at death, you owe that in Oregon inheritance taxes. Then, under the new law, if we assume that we just have the $2 million plus the farm property, it's $286,000. So it's a substantial difference in bracket. I don't have a calculator here with me, but that would be how you'd figure it.
Mr. Chair, I was not on the work group. This is incredibly complicated, and I know that time is short. But I wonder if Mazin has nothing else to do, could give us a snapshot. You've got, say, three or four estates theoretically, and what would happen under, you know, take a small, a middle, and a high, or even... And run these calculations so that would help me a lot, Mr. Chair. And I know the time is short, but this is getting even more complicated as she sits here and discusses it. And I just think it would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
Gelser.
I'm sorry.
It will be an honor to become Representative Berger.
Sorry, Representative Gelser. Thank you.
Thank you. If I'm understanding this correctly, it seems like this perhaps might work within the context of what the initial policy goal was for this bill, which wasn't so much tax relief for the purpose of tax relief, but it was the preservation of the use of agricultural land and resources for agricultural purposes. And it seems that if we've moved the 75% back to the 50%, that it would be relatively progressive in terms of the impact on those other assets in the estate, because the less those additional resources are, the non-farm resources, the lower that bracket would be and the lower the tax. And as you moved closer to that 50%, it would be higher. And to me, that does not seem inconsistent with the goal that we had, which was to preserve the farm use rather than... I hadn't seen this as primarily a tax relief package on non-farming purposes. And then I would start to wonder about the fairness for people that have other types of assets in their estates when we move beyond just that land use purpose.
Representative Barnhart. Thank you.
Representative Gelser, one of the reasons it's a good policy question and why the practitioners are asking this is because, remember, in addition to Oregon inheritance tax, the farmer has very limited relief under the federal estate tax. And so if they have $2 million and $7.5 million of farm property, they will be paying federal inheritance tax, also known as the estate tax, at the bracket of 45% for everything above $3 million. So that's why the question is there. Are they going to have enough cash to pay both state and federal tax and preserve their farmland? And if we're offering tax credit, they're going to be paying more Oregon inheritance tax and have less available to pay federal inheritance tax. And if they do that, they're going to have to sell property to come up with cash.
I think you've stated the question. Why don't you go on to the other three questions you had? We're running out of time.
Okay. The second issue that the bar has is, does the committee want to require some participation requirement?
And that really was the question that I had that I was hoping you were going to answer was the definition that we've included in the dash fours that came directly from Mr. Sheen yesterday, and what that would do and whether or not that actually accomplishes the job we were hoping for. And that was the thing I was hoping that you were going to address.
We do not want a material participation requirement.
No, that wasn't the question.
Yeah, if
the question
there is
was
one,
how does this one actually work, and does it accomplish the committee's goals?
We believe that an active management standard, which is much lower, we believe that by the committee adopting the active management language, it will be a much lower standard than material participation. As long as that's understood, that it's a much lower standard,
that's what we were aiming for, was a lower standard.
That will work.
Yeah, that will work as a lower standard. Thank you. That was that was the question that I had.
Okay.
that I asked you to come up and address.
Any others?
Were other issues, other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Colleagues, the reason I asked for that is that when we had the work group discussion, there was a lot of concern about active participation using the federal code as a definition for the look back and the look forward for qualification on this property. And using the active management definition instead, which is what this amendment does, actually is a lower standard, and is likely to qualify people under far more circumstances than the active participation rule.
Excuse me, it's the language.
If you look at lines 28 through 30, for the purpose of this subsection, to participate means to engage in active management. It means to engage in active management as defined in...
Okay, so it isn't the whole code, it's just the active management
piece. That's right,
piece.
It's the active management piece that we're including. We've left out the Internal Revenue Code active participation rule.
Okay.
We've left that out. I had to read this about four times before I understood that that's what Mr. Sheen meant by it.
Got it.
But that's clearly what he meant, and it's also clear, I think, for the people who have to administer this thing. Are there other questions to deal with at this moment on this bill? Representative Rosenberg?
No, Mr. Chair, I don't have a specific question, but I do want to say it highlights to me my ongoing frustration, which is that the stated goals, as Representative Gelser said, were to direct this tax relief to family farmers to enable them to continue and maintain these family farms as family farms and not be unduly penalized. And while I'm well aware that everything in the tax code is complicated and nothing in this committee is ever simple, this is not a regular legislative session. This is a session that does not have very much more time to work on these bills. And as one member of the committee, I want to state that I want to be voting for a bill knowing what it does, not having ambiguity at the final moment. And so it is hard when we think we're addressing some of the testimony and then we come back a week later and we still seem to have concerns. So I think, and I'm sure there's everybody in the audience knows the truth of what I'm saying, is that there is just no time to continue to work this the way we would during a regular session. And if people want a bill, they need to really come to grips with that the options narrow when you get
down to
right.
the time to act, which I think is coming pretty soon here.
I'm absolutely correct on this and all other bills that we're dealing with. But may I just add to that comment this idea? I don't believe that everyone in the state of Oregon is going to end up agreeing with every aspect of this bill. The issue, it seems to me, is is this bill better or not better than the current law that we have? I think that what we've been hearing is expressions of different understandings of what the state's policy ought to be. And, of course, the legislature needs to determine what the state's policy is. But the question, I think, it really comes down to, is this bill better than the existing law, or isn't it, from the standpoint of the whatever point of view you're taking? And if it is better, then we ought to adopt it, and if it isn't better, then we shouldn't. And in that sense, it is simple. And I appreciate, Representative Rosenbaum, your comment, because this is precisely what I've been trying to do as we work this bill, is to get this thing more concrete, more certain, with fewer chances of litigation, which is exactly what the issue was that the lawyers group raised with us when they raised it back in October or November, when they were telling us that the law that we have now isn't manageable. Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your comments, and Representative Rosenbaum. I just wanted to also reiterate that I think this is our experience in the 2007 session to now has illustrated the complexity of this, and what we thought we were doing, we didn't do it exactly right. I suspect that we're closer on this, but one of the lessons from that experience is that we may not know until we've accumulated some evidence from the experience. So as we're moving towards something we believe is better than the current policy, it doesn't mean that the discussion is over. And I think that will likely come back if something doesn't work as we intended it, and continue the discussion and try to move closer. And I hope that we're able to move it forward.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Dance.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment to build on some remarks yesterday. I had asked if it was the committee's intent to include livestock in the definition of tangible farm property. I assume it is, but I want to make sure.
That's a good question. Is Elsie here?
Yes, she is.
Oh, would you come forward and maybe answer that question? I thought you did, too.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Kate Fossil from Legislative Council, and I had looked at the definitions, and in fact, the definitions have been, I think, tightened up a little bit since the -3s, and it is my understanding, Representative Vance and members of the committee, that tangible property would include the livestock because of the clause devoted to use as a farm or used for farm or forestry purposes, and I believe the use for farm purposes would cover the livestock.
Thank you. And the Department of Revenue was here listening to this testimony, so
thank you.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you.
I'll get it right.
Yeah, you will. And I just wanted to add, for the record, I share some of the discomfort around this bill. I was much more comfortable, actually, when we started last week. It seems that the ball continues to move. And knowing the amount of work and thought and effort we were able to put into it during the 2007 session, I worry about the unintended consequences if we move too quickly now. And my deep concern is that as this ball keeps moving, I am very concerned that we're broadening the scope of what the intent of this bill originally was. And if that's a policy decision that we want to make, that's a great decision to have. But I don't feel like the frame of this conversation is very clear. And I would like to be reassured that we are still staying within the frame that was, we don't want the trees to come down too early, we don't want farms to get sold off for development. But I feel like we're moving more into how can we take a class of people and reduce their estate tax liability beyond that issue. And I think that that begs a question of fairness for other business owners in the state of Oregon who have also worked very hard throughout their lifetimes to build their businesses and develop their assets. And I want to be sure that we're fair in the policies that we put together. It made sense to me when it was about land use protection, but I think all business owners are worthy of the same amount of respect.
Yes, Representative Barker.
And Mr. Chair, if you would like to open this to a broader discussion of eliminating estate taxes, I am at the table with you at any time.
I'd rather not. I think those are both very excellent comments. The reality is that what we were trying to do last time and what we're continuing to try to do is to apply this to family farm, family tree lot ownership, family fishing businesses, and not apply it to anything else. That was our object, and I think this bill does reflect that object as it exists today with the -4 amendments. When you start getting into conversations about the rates that were raised by the witness and other issues, then I think we do run the risk of getting way beyond that. And I will remind you that we're in a fiscally dangerous situation today after the last revenue report. This bill, it has a manageable revenue impact. If we were to start making changes in those other areas, it would no longer be manageable. Yes. Was there anything else on this at this moment?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, I just would like to remind you that I always seem to get those easy bills.
Yes, you do.
Yes. So,
150 for it.
So just with the issue with the Representative Berger and the rate, I'll be happy to make some examples. However, some assumptions need, of course, to be made. In this bill, I believe we define what property is in and out. And with the current law, the one that was quoted, it's probably, as the Department of Revenue said, it's unworkable to define these. For example, in Woodland, the department's interpretation does not include trees, for example. And if it doesn't include trees, then they're at a different ballgame. And then
that's right.
And it doesn't include perhaps entities and so on. But the theory of how this works.
That was the other piece.
Yeah.
The theory of how this works, Representative Berger, for example, if you have $5 million worth of total natural resource property under this proposed amendment, you would end up with paying absolutely no tax. You would give the credit equal to them. The thing becomes after we get, let's say, at the $10 million level, you need to estimate your taxes according to this table, Table B, as we passed it to you, which means it puts you at a base payment of $1,082,800, and then what's the difference above the $10 million? You pay the 16%. Okay, then you take your whatever your qualification, let's assume 50%, and you take your $5 million credit, and that $5 million is you go down to the $5 million, that's $290,000, probably less or more, $290,800 plus 11.2 is the difference.
Which is closer to the 402.
Right. Exactly, which is closer to the 402,800. That's the amount of credit that you take out of your liability. That's how it works. The way that it was described, and it might, or theoretically it would work, if all the other assumptions in this bill work the same way. Not the other bill. Yeah. All the other assumptions in this bill work, but with a different table, what it would say is you take off that $4 million, you're left with $6 million. Instead of paying the 16% on it, what you would be paying, you go down to the 12%. That's how a classic exclusion rather than a credit. So it is absolutely the difference between how you deal with it in an exclusion way versus how you deal with it in a credit way.
Right. Thank you. That's very helpful. Is there anything else on the bill at this moment? We're still having conversations about the bill, and we're obviously not ready to work it at this moment. So we're going to close the work session
on 3618 and open a work session on
3618. And I should tell you that we have reserved hearing room C for 7 o'clock tonight.
in the event that we decide that we're going to try to finish up this bill tonight. We're opening a work session on House Bill 3619, Betsy bill, and I will note that we've received the Dash 10 amendments, and we're also looking at the Dash 7 amendments that have to do with the housing credit. I'm sorry, the Dash 11, we have the Dash 11s now. Thank you. Throw away the Dash 10s and look at the Dash 11s.
We're writing a new section on the Dash 11s. And do we want Dexter to come and talk?
Colleagues, we've had a significant conversation about what the purpose of this bill was and how we were trying to make it work last time, and I would like Dr. to talk about the changes between the Dash 8s and the Dash 11s, because I think that's the key to where we are now.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. Of course, I have to remember what was in the Dash 8s, but
that was
there we go. We have one change begins last line on page 2, following on first paragraph of page 3. This we add some language that makes it clear that the director, when certain economic conditions, for example, or other conditions exist that are listed further on page 3, that the director need not certify any amount, or can certify a lesser amount than the cost of a facility. That you see on page 3, lines 1 through 4.
So the thing between the commas was added.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Next change is... okay. On page 6, there is a new... subsection 6. This basically should be read in conjunction with the new provisions allowing the Department of Energy to describe and rule what constitutes a single facility. And it will allow an applicant to apply for example, if they wanted to roll out a series of facilities over a period of time, it would allow an applicant to apply for all of the facilities at once, and those preliminary certifications will remain valid for a 5-year period, so that which is longer than they otherwise would, so that they can roll out a series of facilities over a period of time. Next change is...
Most of the definition.
The order of my amendments is the pagination is wrong. Is it okay on the ones you've got?
Oh.
Yeah, okay. What is this mine then? The next change is actually on page 9, and it involves a little bit of clarification on the so-called clawback provisions.
Actually, there's another one on section 4, isn't there? Page lines 24 and 25. Section 4, page 8, lines 24 and 25, where you actually took some language out of the existing law.
Okay. Well, this is part of the clawback.
Yes.
This basically allows the Department of Energy to revoke the certificate under any under circumstances where the holder of the certificate has operated the facility in a way that where it wouldn't qualify for the credit.
Right.
So it removes language about a higher standard of substantially failing to construct or make every reasonable effort. Those are now out, and it's and simply if they are operating, if they've constructed or operated the facility in a way that doesn't comply with
the credits. And it still gives the director an out because he may do this. He doesn't have to.
That's correct.
Okay.
Then the next, and really the only other changes have to do with the rest of the clawback provisions that you see on page 9. And there are really two ways that this clawback works. One, if there is, and I'll go through both of them. The first is if there's no transfer. In that instance, and what happens is the certificate is revoked, and to the extent the certificate holder, the person who is operating the facility, has benefited from the tax credits, though that dollar amount is the Department of Revenue is authorized to collect. But if, for example, the taxpayer was only able to claim 5% of a total of 100% of the credit, they would only be able to collect that 5%, not the entire theoretical amount. This rule is different in the case where the certificate has been transferred to some other person who's unrelated to the facility. In that case, the Department of Revenue is authorized to collect, in fact, the entire theoretical amount of the credit, but cannot collect any of it from the transferee, the person who has purchased the credit from the original applicant. And the language, the new language that you see, basically lines 5 through 26, reflects that.
Okay.
Now, those are the changes.
Thank you. There was another issue that was raised by Mr. Graney yesterday around timing. Did you make some changes on that?
A very minor change. Line 29, the original amendment had said for preliminary certification filed on or after January 2008. It is now, as Mr. Graney wanted.
Approved. Thank you. I'd forgotten exactly what we'd agreed to.
Yeah.
All right. Colleagues, any questions for Dexter or discussion?
Chair, are you ready for a motion?
I have a comment, Mr. Chair. Again, this is an incredibly complex and complicated thing, but I think we're there. I would like noted at section 2, line 21, there is a change that I asked Dexter to make it clear that the total, it wasn't the total cost of the facility that gets a credit, but that portion. Okay. And that was at the suggestion of Representative Vance. He spotted it. I was the one that just went to Dexter and said, let's make this clear, and he did.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Actually,
I'd like to take credit here, but I have to
give
him
a substantial
way.
Improvement.
It is an improvement in, yeah. in the language of existing law, which we were all paying so much attention to changes that we didn't catch that.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, may I just make a comment?
Yes.
It is a change in the language, but the intent is not to change the way existing law operates in terms of
right.
caps.
I appreciate that Representative Berger and Representative Benz found a possible ambiguity and fixed it. The reason we're here is because of ambiguities, and the fewer of them we have when we're done, the better.
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 11 amendments to House Bill 3619, dated today, February 12th.
Is there a further discussion on the Dash 11s? Is there any objection to the Dash 11s? I don't see any. The Dash 11s are adopted. Representative Reed, Sevens?
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the Dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3619. These are the ones I think dated February 8th.
That's fine, though. I'm looking in the wrong bill file. That won't work. Try again. The colleague 7 is the one having to do with the housing credit.
Right.
Representative Reed moves the dash 7 amendments to House Bill 3619. Discussion. Yes, Representative Bass.
Yes, I want to make sure the record is clear that I have a conflict on this bill and that I represent an individual who may take advantage of selling some units under this that was allowed under this bill. So I'm sure the record reflects that.
Thank you very much. Representative Bentz notes a conflict, a potential conflict of interest, and the record will so reflect. Is there any further discussion on this matter? We did have an extensive conversation about it yesterday. Is there any objection to the dash sevens? Seeing none, the dash sevens are adopted. Representative Reed?
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 3619 as amended be passed to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Reed moves the bill as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Ben. You abstain.
You have to vote yes or no.
Yes or no? I vote yes.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Burns.
Aye.
Representative
Yeltsin.
Aye.
Representative
Hickman.
Excuse? Representative
Reed.
Aye.
Representative
Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative
Flint.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Chair votes aye. The measure having received the required majority is declared passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation and I'll carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3619. Colleagues, we're going to meet tonight. We have before us the either the Senate bill or the House bill on the reconnect, and further conversation or further work session on House Bill 3619. So we'll recess until 7 p.m. in Hearing Room C. Right? Thank you. We are recessed.
Thanks.